Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Mum's the Word edition. It's Wednesday, November 21st, 2018. Widows is the latest from director Steve McQueen. It stars Viola Davis as the widow of a legendary Chicago criminal who must save her own skin and pull off one last big heist. And then Bodyguard is a shiny, pulpy BBC import thriller. It's about a hottie guarding another hottie. And finally... Tell me I'm wrong. And then finally, William Goldman was maybe the greatest American screenwriter since Ben Hecht, maybe the greatest of all time. His death this past week at the age of 87 has us asking, what was his legacy? Certainly it was remarkable, but what else was his legacy? And who and what is a screenwriter then and now? Joining me today is, oh my gosh, the words, they just form so Pavlovianly in my mouth. You are not the editor of Slate. Julia, the end of a friggin' era. What are you? What manner of creature are you?
I'm a deputy managing editor at the LA Times.
We're still dealing.
And the offices, are they a straight shot down the 405 from LAX?
No, they are like at LAX. They're a straight shot down the 405 from my home.
Oh my God! You've turned into
Sheryl Crow. She actually becomes Sheryl Crow while driving to work.
I was going to say she's turned into a Warren Zevon song in the month. Well, anyway, welcome back. Your huge shoes were you know, we filled them with water and people swam around in them like they were swimming pools. But we did get
oh,
by.
Oh come
we,
on! You guys had such great shows, but I am so happy to be back in conversation with you. Very know, early in the morning on my end, so we'll see how sprightly I can keep it.
I know. How exciting. And of course, Slate's film critic is Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, boring old me. Same old, same old.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Boring us. All right. So why don't we dig right in, starting with the movie. Steve McQueen has made a curious what's it of a movie. Dana, I love asking you, what's Steve McQueen known for best?
Well, I mean, you in the U.S., I guess 12 Years a Slave is his, you know, it's his Oscar-winning movie and the first movie of his that probably many Americans saw. But this is his fifth film, I believe. He had already made a couple of movies, which we can talk about in this segment earlier in Britain, and one here, that were much more on the arty end and very dark. And he seems in general to be drawn to films that have some sort of social conscience and that are about very painful experiences. So Widows, actually, as a heist movie and a thriller, is something of a departure for him, and in some other ways not.
Yeah, exactly. So it's part a heist caper, part a feminist essay, maybe, part a tone poetical study of grief. Liam Neeson is a Chicago-based criminal. And as only movies can deliver one, I have to say he's sleek, handsome, yuppie, a loving husband. He's in a biracial marriage. When a big job goes horribly wrong, grotesquely wrong, he leaves his wife, played by Viola Davis, widowed and in hock to some really, really, really scary dudes. She makes a team of the other widows from her husband's crew. That's like a very high concept way of reducing a complex and multi-layered plot. Anyway, the movie stars Michelle Rodriguez, Elizabeth Debicki, Colin Farrell, Cynthia Erivo. I should say also the screenplay notably is co-written by Gillian Flynn. Let's listen to a clip.
Our go date is in 3 days, the night of the debate. Now, all of our work is worth nothing if we don't move this money and fast. The notebook says $5 million. That's exactly the amount of money Mulligan was accused of taking in commission kickbacks. So over here, we have $2 million, 20 Tupperware boxes. Each box is $100,000 in $100 bills. It weighs 44 pounds. Now, over here, we have $2 million. 40 Tupperware boxes. Each box has $50,000 in $50 bills. It weighs 88 pounds.
I feel like I'm in school.
Tell me about it.
We gotta start thinking like professionals. We're in business together. There's not gonna be some cozy reunion. After this job, we're done. We have 3 days to look and move like a team of men. The best thing we have going for us is being who we are.
Why?
Because no one thinks we have the balls to pull this off.
Oh my, no one thinks they have the balls to pull it off. Dana, that's I would argue that's a pretty unrepresentative clip. It's both, I should say, totally the high concept in one little nugget and sort of unrepresentative of what the film is. What'd you make of this movie?
Yeah, that is an atypical clip, and it was used in the trailers, of course, because it's the suspenseful heist thriller part. But in a way, I think that's the weakest part of this movie, and it certainly, in terms of screen time, is one of the smaller parts of the movie. In fact, in your setup, I mean, I understand why, because this is a lot of plot. This is actually boiled down from a BBC miniseries that I think had 12 episodes or something. So there's even more plot jammed in there, where Colin Farrell plays this corrupt Chicago politician who is the son of Robert Duvall. His father was also a corrupt Chicago politician. And so there's also this upcoming election between him and this gang boss played by Brian Tyree Henry from Atlanta. And so the concept is that the women are trying to pull off this heist on the same night that the big debate is happening in this election runoff between these two men. So there's this almost Godfather-like sense of parallelism there. And I think this movie... It's a real crowd pleaser. People greatly enjoyed it in the screening I went to. I greatly enjoyed everything to do with the women and their plan to pull off the heist. But I think this movie has a little too much going on and is not as sure in its boots when it comes to crime and political drama. In some ways, I don't know if you felt this, you guys felt this too, but you felt the non-Americanness of the director, something about the way the election was set up and even the questions of race were handled. At moments in 12 Years a Slave, I felt this too, that it felt like an outsider's view on America. And I don't mean that in a xenophobic way. I mean, a British director has every right to make an American-style movie and look at it in his own way. But there was something that didn't feel quite native and natural, particularly about the political standoff as it was painted between these two figures running for alderman.
Julia, what'd you make of it?
I'm still mulling Dana's analysis because I had a similar feeling of having been completely wrapped in the theater. I think the performances are across the board marvelous. Your litany of astonishing actors in this film leaves out Carrie Coon, who has a very small but pivotal role. And it's certainly quite entertaining to watch all of these people exchange views and attitude and be surprised by one another and what fate has in store for them. But I don't know, I woke up this morning and it all crumbled in my head. Like, I'm not quite sure what it adds up to. Or I think maybe it's trying to add up to too much. I mean, your note that it was a tone poem on grief, Steve, I think is really interesting because I do think that it is simultaneously trying to be a blockbuster heist that also has things to say about race, politics, class, gender, and grief. And necessarily, I think because it's tackling such huge topics, it's a little bit impressionistic in all of them. And some of those impressions are incredibly powerful. I mean, just as a director, the filmmaking is more elegant than, and more thoughtful and more intriguing than, for example, what we saw in Ocean's 8, the recent female heist movie, the most recent female heist movie I can think of. But I'm not quite sure what it all adds up to. I think that's where I'm left. However, I'm not sure that like the Britishness of his perspective on these things is where I would put my finger in trying to figure out why this doesn't seem why this seems less than the sum of its parts somehow.
Yeah, I don't think the Britishness is the center of it. I'm just trying to cast around for answers to that same question, is that why are so many of the elements great? And we didn't even mention that Daniel Kaluuya, of the hero of Get Out, plays this terrifying villain, and he's great in the role as well. And so all of these elements are wonderful, and many individual scenes are great. There's this Elizabeth Debicki, who is fantastic in her role as this, I don't know how you describe her, but she's a young woman who spent her whole life being pushed around, right? Her husband was abusive to her. It's established at the beginning. He's one of the criminals in the ring. Her mother, played by Jackie Weaver, another, you know, A-list incredible actress in a tiny role, kind of pushes her into this sort of high-end prostitution job. I mean, she clearly is a person who has spent her life having decisions made for her by other people. And there's this great scene where she is assigned by Viola Davis to go to a gun show and get them all Glocks for the holdup. And she kind of finds her voice at this gun show and does a bunch of pulls some ruses so that she can get the weapons she needs. And she's fantastic in that scene. And so each of these individual scenes is a gem, but I still had this feeling almost as if there were parts left out, as if this were a miniseries and we were only seeing the highlight reel of the entire thing.
Yeah. I mean, it is a very, very full stocking, this movie. I kind of admired all of the parts and wasn't sure about the sum of them, even though I was grateful, you know, for having seen it. But what I found unsuccessful about this movie was it absolutely refused the high concept execution on its own high concept premise. So that scene that we heard is totally unrepresentative. You know, like we're women, we're going to pull this off. We're the widows. We got balls, right? And the rest of the movie almost studiedly disavows this approach to the material, and instead is all about loss, grief, violence, and, you know, American politics and Chicago, like, you know, the kind of political ecosystem of Chicago. And what I found was when the genre elements were kind of, you know, the fingers of the movie snapped and the genre elements were asked to dance, you know, to kind of deliver the movie as a movie, they went together oddly in some ways. So you had very, very real emotions, very real social observation set against really improbable genre elements, and sometimes I thought kind of flimsy genre elements, and these two things together didn't form a coherent blend. That said, like everyone,
the fact that we're all meh on it though is making me want to defend it, because I'm not happy with this, with our conclusion being three rounds of meh. So on the one hand, we've all identified some kind of overambitious, what, overstuffedness, right? On the other hand, like, there are so many aspects of this movie that were extraordinary, and wouldn't you rather see 20 of these a year than 20 of almost any other type of movie we've seen? You know, even the sheer fact that child care for the heisters is an issue and comes up. Viola Davis, who is rich and does not have children in her care, demands that they meet at 11:15 at a warehouse, and the two single moms who are trying to like be in this caper with her are like, but that's like a really, that's hard. They're not like, couldn't it be 11:15 in the morning when they're in school? Like, what an amazing thing. When have you ever seen them worry about childcare for heist before? Like, what a delightful detail, and what a modern detail. What an interesting way to think about things. You know, in some ways, I think this movie reminds me a little bit of Get Out. I mean, I adored Get Out and think it's basically perfect. And I obviously don't think that about this movie. But the notion that somehow where Hollywood has left directors is trying to jam ideas into blockbuster and or genre formats kind of results in some interesting and fresh things. Like, even if this is slightly unsuccessful, it's slightly unsuccessful in an interesting, fresh, modern, I'd love to see a bunch more of them way. So maybe that feels like a condescending praise or something, but I that's my half-hearted muster of a day.
Yeah,
I
would concur. I don't even feel meh about this movie. It's more like it's a rocky terrain with peaks and valleys, but the peaks are real, and it's a really enjoyable experience. I mean, I wish that we had understood a little bit more about the details of the heist so that it was kind of more satisfying in a plot way when things clicked into place or didn't click into place, or, you know, when they went wrong at the heist. But ultimately, I don't think Steve McQueen is as interested in the genre elements as he is in disrupting the genre, and that's interesting and cool. And somebody else just occurred to me, another great actor in this movie who has, I think, too small of a role, but Cynthia Erivo, the Broadway, Tony-winning Broadway star, has a role as a babysitter and precisely fits into that whole, the whole childcare subplot.
All right. Well, we're on, I hate to say we're on a fence. We're on an incredibly interesting fence that I think we're all grateful to be on. So go see the movie and
like
tell
none
us,
of us would say you shouldn't see this film, right?
Absolutely.
Don't you think everyone should see it, even though we're kind of mushy about it?
Yeah.
No, I totally agree. Yeah. No, go see it and then tell us how we're wrong.
Vehement positive ambivalence. That's where we are.
I love it. All right, it's Widows, and we're at facebook.com/culturefest. Tell us what you thought. All right, moving on. All right, before we go any further, I'm sure we have some business. Julia, this doesn't concern you. Dana, what do you have?
Yeah, I know. I'm the business lady now. Thanks, Steve. Our annual call-in show is coming up. That is our main piece of business. Once a year, usually around the holidays when we're trying to pack a lot of things in, we do one episode where we take listener questions via voicemail. We play your question and then we chew it over and answer it on the air. Can you guys think of some examples of great questions from years past, the kind of things that we like people to send in? I mean, I really hate to even put that many barriers down because it should just be whatever question you want to ask. But what are some culture questions we've gotten that have been fun to answer?
Oh, my God. I feel like we've been asked about everything from like floral arrangements to Proustian Madeleines of our childhood to weird hypotheticals about if you could go to any kind of city decade combo in geography/history, where would you go? You know, all the good stuff.
Yeah, we've gotten thrown some conundrum style questions like the ones the Political Gab Fest does, right? Just sort of logical puzzles or things that are just fun to talk about, parlor game questions. Really, whatever you've always wanted to hear us talk about and we've never done a segment on would be great. Throw us a movie, throw us a book, favorite this, favorite that.
Sometimes we get like, you never talked about this. What about this?
Yeah, and that's kind of great to realize there might be something major that got by us that we always wanted to talk about but never realized. So if you want to leave us one of those questions and hopefully hear it answered on the air in a future episode, you can call this number, 323-628-1889. That's 323-628-1889. You will get a voicemail box and you can leave us a question. Steve, also next up in business, I believe you have a small correction about something said on a recent show. What was that?
I do indeed. I regret making an error, which is that thanks to the conglomeration of publishing houses, Penguin, in some technical sense, is publishing The Gulag Archipelago with an introduction by Jordan Peterson. It is not coming out as a Penguin classic. It seems to be coming out, if my information in front of me is correct, as a vintage classic, which is different. I still think it's an abomination. I still think they shouldn't have done it. I hope no one buys it, but of course, many, many people will. But it doesn't taint Penguin classics and their introductions, which I've endorsed in the past and which I think are amazing. So just to keep those two things separate, it is not a Penguin classic. You don't have to throw your Penguin Freud and your Penguin Marx and your Penguin this and your Penguin that into the trash can.
And actually start shooting penguins from helicopters out of just rage.
Oh my God.
Where did you guys take this show while I was off? My God.
Took a dark. Oh my Lord.
Oh my.
All right. So we know what book not to buy. Also, in our Slate Plus segment today, we are going to be spoiling Widows. This is a last-minute call by Julia. We were going to talk about something else in Plus, and then she said, you know what? There's so many twists in Widows. She doesn't understand the last scene. We wanted to talk about some of the stuff that we couldn't talk about without ruining the movie for you. So if you have seen Widows or don't plan to see Widows but would like to hear it spoiled, that's what we're going to do in the Slate Plus segment today. To hear segments like that and to get ad-free podcasts, you can sign up for Slate Plus, Slate's membership program, which is a great way to support the magazine and the journalism we do. For $35 for your first year, you can help cover the cost of producing the Culture Gab Fest and all your other favorite Slate shows. And in return, you will get extended ad-free versions of this show and all the other great Slate podcasts and many other wonderful benefits. So if you want to support the Culture Gab Fest, please go to slate.com/culture plus and join Slate Plus today. Okay, Steve, back to the show.
Thanks, Dana. All right, moving on. Bodyguard is a sexy British import. It's now on Netflix. It's ooh-la-la. Setup is an Afghan war vet gets a high-profile job as bodyguard to the Home Secretary, to Madam Home Secretary. And they're both hot. Did I mention they're very hot? Intrigue and the sexies ensue, though as a backdrop to the whole drama is something quite serious, which is the PTSD of the title character. It stars Richard Madden as David Budd and Keely Hawks as Julia Montague. It's pulpy fun. Let's listen to a clip.
Hi, it's me. We need to catch up. Come to the flat. Not sure what time I'll be home. Depends on the traffic.
Cross the river and take the south sock.
Terry's been driving me for 3 years. I think he can be trusted to determine the fastest route.
I've made a dynamic risk assessment, and given the current threat level, I'm recommending a diversion.
How much longer will that take?
Can't say for certain, Mum.
But in that case, we'll just take the usual route, please, Terry.
Take the south sock, if you don't mind. My job's to keep you safe, Mum. I won't tell you how to do yours.
No, but you're happy to make it harder.
Okay, I mean, there's Julia, a kind of, aura of electric reticence between these two characters, especially in those early scenes. Well, what did you make of this? I had a lot of fun watching it, but, anyway, what did you make of this?
What fun. I mean, what miserable, dark, doomy, gloomy, thematic, surveillance state, terror, fear of citizen. PTSD. It sort of bats about a bunch of very dark and serious subjects with its clever paws, but like really this is just a purring cat wanting to settle into our laps and treat us to a delightful, suspenseful souffle of tense thrillerdom. That is my verdict. Extremely fun, possibly slightly glibly taking very serious subjects in order to entertain us with taut suspense.
Disagree.
Ooh, not fun or not about anything?
I mean, I'm not that invested in it. I guess I don't understand. Apparently, this was a huge, huge hit in Britain, right? It had people on the edge of their seats. It was unlike here where it was dumped in Netflix all in one 12-episode season. It was aired serially there and apparently was, keeping the entire nation on the edge of their seats waiting for the next installment. And it is true that each episode ends on a twist that, leads you into the next. It's very Netflixy in that way. But this felt so familiar to me. I'm just surprised that something that so generically recycles themes that we've seen in, 24, Homeland. I mean, certainly in the U.S., lots and lots of shows have taken this kind of security paranoia, post 9/11 security paranoia, I would call it, and turned it into glib entertainment in some way or another. And this just didn't seem terribly differentiated from that. I kept waiting for, okay, so what's the touch going to be that makes it a 2018 version of this Kiefer Sutherlandish, sexy spy romp? And that never really came along. I mean, I'm only 3 episodes in. I suppose that it could turn into something completely different. But Steve, did you also feel that you were in overfamiliar territory?
I thought that, and I loved being there because in a weird way, overfamiliar territory has become underfamiliar territory in the age of super gourmet peak, TV, prestige TV. This is the anti-Romanoffs. This is got none of the ticks and jiggles of super fancy, quote unquote, edgy. I mean, so the subject matter, yes. I mean, the I think in many ways somewhat shallow treatment of his PTSD.
And somewhat so far, somewhat shallow treatment also of the Muslim terrorists that they're after.
No, absolutely. But we have gone so long on the show, and I think for good reason, without doing a network TV show. And this is the British equivalent of network, if you ask me. It's like implausibly hot people and acting implausibly hot, or just totally implausible scenarios. And it just kind of worked for, it was like a vacation or something. It was like, I kind of loved being on the sunny beach of this, nonsense. I mean, it's just
the sunny beach of this grim, rainy, terror-racked city.
Yeah, because I mean, first of all of the political intrigue is just overwrought and, to my mind, completely incredible. I mean, it doesn't have any sense that you're actually eavesdropping on the world as it's actually run. But I just didn't care. It's just genre TV. I mean, it's sort of the opposite of Widows, right? It's like completely unapologetic about its genre-ness. I like both of them. I mean, I think they're both just fantastically, I keep saying it, they're just so hot. I mean, I feel like I'm thruppling with them when I watch this. He's this pretty boy in a kind of Alain Delon. It's like if you took Alain Delon and Ewan McGregor and you gene spliced them, you'd get him. And she's just, she's just like, I don't even know. I don't want to get in trouble. But it's just, And so to me, it just was such a passive and guilty pleasure. I mean, I think I'm 2.5 hours into it, maybe a little more, and I'm absolutely going to watch every last second of the show.
Wow. Okay, I really felt felt that I was checking it off in order to talk about it with you guys after a couple episodes. I mean, isn't it annoying how the children and the wife of this main character are just bait? Like, I don't know. I mean, this show is not overtly sexist in any way, and many of the main characters, including powerful politicians, are female. But I still feel like it's about a guy who protects women, and his children are little bits of bait that are dangled in front of terrorists occasionally to get your blood rushing.
But I think, well, first of all, who wants to spend more time with the children? I mean, in a thriller, like, they're supposed to just be bait. What do you want? You want, like, to actually, like, be on the floor doing blocks with them? Like, forget about it. Also, I would argue that one thing that makes this feel more modern, and it is a again, it is glibly treated, I think, but in a way that makes it satisfying, is how aimed at a female audience this is. I think in part because of the matter of fact depictions of many women in positions of power. There are basically three female bosses that our main character David Budd, which, did you guys spot that he was Robb Stark, King of the North? I did not spot that until I read the reviews, because he's so shorn of all his shaggy hair.
I don't know what that means. Is that a Game of Thrones reference?
From Game of Thrones.
No, I would not have recognized him for that reason.
All right, fair enough. Anyway, you know, that we meet this sort of Hanna Rosin end of men character who's been sent off by the elites to fight in Afghanistan, has come back damaged and disillusioned about power, and also to find that everyone who's in charge of him is a woman. He has a female boss who has a female boss, and those female bosses assign him to protect this other female boss lady type. And yes, he is a man protecting a woman, but the woman is the woman charged with protecting the entire nation of England and all the moms and kids there, and who's choosing to pursue it in an inflammatory and particular way, driven by her own will, ideas, and ambitions. And he is the kept help. And I think that the way in which that, you know, I mean, there is just, this has been remarked on in many of the reviews, but he, in a British manner, says, "Mom, I don't even know how to do the vowel that he puts between the two M's in the word that we would pronounce in America as ma'am. It's like mum. It's like marmalade without the R. Like, it's like, I feel like someone should just do a supercut of all of the ma'ams that he says, mum, mum, mum. But he inflects the word mum as a response to receiving direction from a female boss with so much meaning, so many, you know, pride, happiness, defiance, begrudgment, like, mm-hmm. And he just has to keep submitting to these women in power. So A, you get to see, you know, hot Robb Stark submitting to all these female bosses of dubious purpose. And then you have this, she's kind of ageless, this woman, this home secretary, but, you know, so she's middle-aged, she's played, of course, she's a very glamorous middle age. I've, like, never wanted a buoyant bob so much as in watching her hair in various scenes in this miniseries. But it's, like, plausible that a woman of that, like, face and body could have that position somehow. It's not like they just hired Jessica Biel and was like be Secretary of State or something. And, you know, without spoiling too much, she, like, is an object of, like, lust and, you know, enjoys a robust sexual self on top of being the boss lady of the security state. I don't know, just the gender flip. Like, that's not what Kiefer Sutherland was up to. And honestly, it's not even really what Carrie Mathison was up to, where she was portrayed as this, you know, just such a crazy emotional woman in the largely male context of counterintelligence and security. So presenting this kind of fantasy that the security state is female somehow, gives it enough of a flip that I found it totally compelling.
Yeah, I can't deny that character has agency and power. She certainly does. I'm not saying this show is somehow, you know, pushing its female characters around and sexist in that sense. I just felt like none of those people were plausible human beings, and I could sort of predict where all of their relationships were going to go. Again, I'm only three episodes in. It could be that there are still twist that would surprise me. But so far, the twists have all been plot related and not character related. No person has surprised me in this show. So even though that figure is well played by Richard Madden, I don't feel that I know him or that I can get to know him. I feel like he's a set of tics and ideas bundled together under a bulletproof vest. And I don't know. This show just does not do it for me. Maybe I'm just not that into... I didn't watch 24 either. Maybe I'm just not that into spycraft genre shows.
I think it is fair. I think that critique is fair, Dana, in that everyone is so untrustworthy. I mean, the show is so shifty in its perspective and allegiances that it is hard to be surprised by character. I think that is an astute observation, because basically you sort of assume that you're wrong about everybody the whole time.
I mean, I presume that people are going to go up and down in our estimation as the show goes on, right? That you're going to be led to trust certain characters, and then the rug will be pulled out and you can't trust them anymore. And that kind of thing is fun in and of itself as a pure plot device. But to me, if there's not an actual person who's unfolding over the course of the series, it's just hard to sustain my interest.
All right. Well, I'm sticking with this one. Hot meets hot. I'm sticking with this one to the end. It's just a brain vacation that I found really fun, but curious to know what our listeners think. You can write us or post on our Facebook page. All right, moving on. This one's near and dear to my heart. William Goldman is just one of my favorite writers / screenwriters. He died this past week at the age of 87, an absolute legend, Hollywood legend and beyond. A list of his films will prove it immediately. I mean, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, All the President's Men, Misery, Harper, a great old Paul Newman flick, The Princess Bride, I mean, which is eternal, and Marathon Man, and I'm sure I'm missing some. Dana, we thought this segment kind of could serve a couple of different purposes. One is just to remember the career, you know, extraordinary career of Goldman, but also just to think a little bit about what a screenwriter is or was, and wonder whether out loud whether that is still the same in this era of, you know, blockbuster filmmaking and prestige TV. But don't let me guide you too much here. I'm curious to know what your feelings are about Goldman and his movies.
Yeah, I mean, like you, maybe a little bit less so than you, but he was a formative writer for me as well, not just his screenplays, but his fiction. And I remember reading Marathon Man, the novel that he later based his own screenplay on. Probably in high school, I read that book. And just, I mean, I'm not a huge reader even now of thrillers and essentially tightly packed genre piece type books. But when they work, man, they're amazing. And Marathon Man is completely one of them. Princess Bride, of course, also another case in which he wrote a novel and then turned it into a movie. And both are great, each in their own way. He found what there was in that book to cinematize, right? And he did it on the page. And how he does that and the way he writes about craft is another part of his writing life that people have been really remembering these last few days as memorials circulate about Goldman. He had so many good books about writing. And I think Adventures in the Screen Trade is one that you and I probably have both read and love, which is in a way a memoir, in a way a screenwriter's manual. It came out in the early 80s. And also just a great, funny, lively glimpse into what working in Hollywood was like in that era. Jason Zinnemann in Slate a couple of days ago wrote an admiring piece about The Season, which is a book he wrote about writing for Broadway. In fact, the play that he wrote for Broadway was a flop, one of the few flops of his career, really. But he still managed to turn it into gold by writing this book that apparently is a great insight into the theater world. So, I mean, I think of him almost as a chronicler of the entertainment industry as much as a producer of movies within it.
Mm-hmm. Julia, is this someone you were, you know, aware of or admired or what?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's been striking. So I asked our listeners, of course, before heading off on my sojourn west, what to consume about Los Angeles. And I've continued that question in other conversations since. And one of the things that's come up most is Adventures in the Screen Trade. Like, just the degree to which everyone thinks this book from decades ago is actually the definitive book about how Hollywood and the entertainment industry work and function and what its anxieties are and how relevant people think that book is. It's like a true totem in a way that is striking. And for someone to have been so good at so many things, to have made movies that are still watched today, in such a variety of genres? Like, do you really think of The Princess Bride as coming from the same hand as All the President's Men? Like, if you didn't know that and you had to pick them all out of a lineup, would you presume that? You would not, right? Like, and it sort of illustrates the variety and depth and dexterousness of his intellect and his brain. I also think there's a way in which his fluidity and sort of explaining Hollywood to itself and to others, and his kind of nimbleness in hopping among mediums raise questions for me about how we think about screenwriters now versus how we thought about screenwriters at the height of his career, and, you know, in the decades prior to it, where it's hard to imagine the modern screenwriter taking on a similar cultural role, or I find it hard to imagine that. Is that something that you... I'm curious what you think of that, Steve, since you've spent a bunch of time thinking about the 70s and the 80s and Hollywood.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, so to begin with, right, it's important to remember the screenwriter has always been this equivocal figure in Hollywood, no matter what the era was. You know, many of the moguls, if not most or all of them, scarcely read. You know, a lot of creative executives do read and read voraciously, but very many of them don't really read at all. They hire people to read for them. There is a general atmosphere, or there has been historically a general atmosphere of contempt for the written word. And yet, in order to start up the whole machinery of Hollywood, you need someone to write a script. And screenwriters famously lack control and autonomy, which is, you know, untrue of other kinds of creative writers. You are hired to do a job. You're very often serving a client. The client might be a powerful director. It might be a studio executive. Whoever it is, a producer, they tend to hold complete, total rights to take what you've given them and rewrite it, hand it to another writer, fire you. You know, by the time a movie ends up on the screen, it's been touched by a lot of different hands. And so there's this way in which the screenwriter is both the kind of, you know, the deity who puts the imaginative cosmos in motion and makes it real. I mean, without a script, you cannot, I mean, you know, obviously you can make a movie without a script and people have done it, but by and large, you cannot make a movie without a script. You probably can't make a good one without a good script. At the same time, the writer becomes, you know, massively devalued. And what was miraculous to me about Goldman is that he was able to write movies so consistently well across so many genres, many of which, certainly 5, 6, 7 more of which, are eminently rewatchable. I mean, you could watch The Princess Bride and then rewatch it again immediately after that. You could watch it with your kids. You could watch it alone. I mean, it's just, he was able to do something really distinctive with his screenwriting. They hold up when you try to, you know, when you just read them without seeing the film. Whether or not someone could be that today, I mean, I just think it's important to remember that it was always a director's medium and not a writer's medium, and that the exception, Ben Hecht, Charlie Kaufman, William Goldman, it's always the exception if you know a screenwriter's name. What's interesting is that we now have a medium that's the showrunner's medium, and the showrunner tends to be a writer and a director, right? Typically, or tends to be the, you know, person who conceptually originates the show, is responsible for its tone and its feeling and its general arc, and runs a writer's room. And that figure, I think, just in the in the cultural imagination, has really supplanted the screenwriter, the writer of the 90-minute to 2-hour film that is not derived from familiar material, original material. Is that kind of movie has disappeared. So Dana, right, that kind of writer is going to disappear inevitably.
I don't know, but maybe it's, as you point out, that it's always an anomaly when one exists, and we do still have Charlie Kaufman, right? I think that maybe there will always continue to be that person who bobs up, who can provide this magical, invisible thing called a screenplay, which, as you say, there's not really a good movie without a good screenplay, right? I don't know. I'm not quite ready to be so hand-wringy as to say we're past the era of the screenwriter. But it does seem like it's harder to get that voice to emerge in a sequel-dominated market.
I do think, I mean, one way to think about it, one of the things you were talking about, Steve, in that the screenwriter is fundamentally serving a client, reminds me of a riff that I'm pretty sure I got from the Script Notes guys. Our regular listeners will know I listen obsessively to Script Notes, the screenwriting podcast. It's good. Check it out. And I think that John August or Craig Mazin, I think Craig, has pointed out that he would much rather be called a craftsman than an artist, that fundamentally the screenwriting is a craft. It's like being an architect or an engineer. You do have a client, you have a set of skills, but there's a certain pride in being a professional, in understanding what the requirements are for this project, and then delivering something that meets the requirements rather than sort of thinking of yourself as on the like high cloud city of art, capital A art. And I think that one of the evolution, you know, one of the things that's interesting right now is with the rise of the showrunner as the kind of lionized figure, maybe over the film director, that does put the position of, you know, that does put the writer in the position of being the artiste, right? Like, that's how you end up with a Romanoffs, right? As you've, Matt Weiner hears for 7 years from some crazy outlets that he's made a really great TV show that's worthy of thousands and thousands of words of scrutiny. And then he kind of gets to make whatever he wants for hours and hours. And then a scant number of people watch it and talk about it. And so, you know, there is kind of pride and suffering, I think, from that craftsman position and the notion of sort of being the beleaguered, important but undervalued figure on the movie set to being the boss on the TV set. And I think the craft of writing is going through a big shift in kind of thinking about the relative positions of movies versus TV in the culture and what that means for writerdom and what that means for the hierarchy and how things get made. And Goldman sort of sang the song of the earlier hierarchy.
Yeah, that's really astute, Julia. I think one place you really see that, Goldman being from a different age of how we considered screenwriters, is that Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid was his first script. That I didn't know that until reading some of these obituaries and memorials about him, that he was a young writer doing his very first screenplay, and that it sold in this kind of remarkable agenting deal where he made, for the time, a very large amount of money for his first screenplay and sort of debuted as a screenplay writing star, which is somewhat hard to imagine now. Someone not coming from the world of TV, not adapting their own book, but just writing an original screenplay, selling it for a bunch of money, and launching themselves into a big career in the business.
I can't exit this segment without saying that you are a great screenwriter if you can write a one-word sentence that almost everyone recognizes immediately as yours, right? Can you think of what that one word is?
I mean, I can think of a couple. Follow the Money is his, right? Which is not even something that came from the book,
that
All
is.
The President's Men.
Data, Follow the Money is three words, a one-word sentence.
Oh, it has to literally be one word. No, I don't have it. What is it?
Inconceivable.
You didn't lisp. It's not real.
All right. Well, William Goldman is, you know, truly one of the great screenwriters of all time. Very curious to know what everyone's favorite William Goldman movie is. If you've never seen Butch Cassidy, you got to watch it. Almost surely you've seen Princess Bride anyway. All right. Well, moving on. All right. Now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Stephen, in place of an endorsement this week, I have a call to action. This calls back to our Slate Plus segment from a couple weeks ago when we mourned the passing of Filmstruck, the great classic film streaming service, which combined Criterion classics and some Warner Brothers classics, and was a place to go as a streaming consumer if you wanted to watch either old movies, foreign movies, hard-to-find gems, etc. And there was a national outpouring of grief from cinephiles, including a lot of high-placed cinephiles like Guillermo del Toro was one of them, and I think Barbara Streisand was another, who all circulated this petition to save Filmstruck, the kind of thing that usually sinks without a trace, but I have a theory that this petition, which got more than 50,000 signatures last time I looked at it, must have had some effect, because now Criterion is saying, they released a press release last week saying that they're going to relaunch in the spring something called the Criterion Channel, which will definitely have all the Criterion classic movies and will also apparently incorporate in some way some of these archival treasures from classic Hollywood. So my endorsement is just to encourage everyone who either loved Filmstruck or hearing about it wishes that they had explored it while it existed to go and become a charter subscriber to the Criterion Channel. They're making this deal right now where if you go and pre-sign up, essentially say, when this launches, I want to be a member, you get a reduced price and you get some other benefits. But the main reason, I think, to do this is just to send them the message, yes, we are interested, because it's one of those, if you build it, they will come scenarios, right? If they get tons and tons and tons of pre-subscriptions for this charter membership thing, then maybe that voting block of consumers will have more power to say, hey, put more old movies on, do this, do that, improve your interface, etc. So if you want to send the message to big faceless corporations like WarnerMedia and AT&T that we would like our classic movies, please, you can go to criterion.com/channel. That's criterion.com/channel. And it's the sign up page for becoming a charter subscriber. And of course, they don't start charging you until whenever they will launch in the spring. So go and do it. Form a mass. Ask for our movies back.
Fantastic. Julia, what do you have?
My recommendation is another of the bits of what to read or consume about Los Angeles advice that I followed during my interim between jobs, was one from listener Josie Ward of a book called Los Angeles, The Architecture of Four Ecologies. And that sounds from the title like a dry monograph, right? It does not necessarily sound like a rollicking read. But it turns out that Rainer Banham was like a Slate writer before there was Slate. This is a, I don't know, maybe 150-page treatise full of photographs making the ultimate pre-Slate Slate pitch that Los Angeles is the height of urban perfection, that it is a city that has a glorious logic, that it is not a automotive ruined traffic snarled mess, but in fact such a thriving success as a metropolis that it challenges all of the pieties of urbanism championed by Jane Jacobs and others during the era when he was writing, in ways that serious East Coast urbanists must reckon with. And it is, I mean, I can't recommend it enough to anyone who is interested in planning Los Angeles, to anyone who's newly arrived in the city and has even a passing interest in design. It's just a great read. The sentences are so tart. The photographs are this wonderful, and there's plenty of maps too, kind of memory lane. And it just gives you a vernacular to think about what you're looking at when you drive around this city. But it's also just incredibly prickly and contrarian, and any point that somebody might have ever made about Los Angeles, he disagrees with. Sometimes more persuasively than others, honestly, but it's incredibly enjoyable regardless of whether it's persuasive. So it's Rainer Banham. If you have not read him, check him out. I've also since learned that there's a whole post-Rainer Banham backlash. Who's this lame Brit coming over? Just like another dumb Easterner presuming to explain Los Angeles to itself. So there's certainly a fuck this guy backlash, but what a great read. Can't wait to read the backlash and hope that it's as sprightly prose-wise.
Can you spell his last name for me, Julie, just so I can look him up more easily?
Banham.
Got it.
All right, I'm going to be very self-derivative here and endorse a show, Happy Valley, that I've endorsed before because I'm on Series 2. It's maybe not quite the sublimity of Season 1, but it's so good. It is the latter-day prime suspect. The showrunner is a woman named Sally Wainwright, the creator. It stars this woman, Sarah Lancashire. I'm sorry, I don't know which one, who's sort of a today's Helen Mirren, you know, or will be tomorrow's Helen Mirren or whatever. I mean, just just the magnificently expressive performance by an actress playing a, you know, career cop who's worn down by sexism and, man's inhumanity to man. But it's just, her performance is so good. It doesn't matter that the second one isn't as tight as the first one. The writing is still fabulous throughout, and she's amazing. You just cannot take your eye off of her face. Like, all of human suffering seems to devolve upon her, and yet she's got this magnificent spirit. It's really good TV. Have you guys watched it?
No, I remember June Thomas endorsing it, actually. She was passionate about it. Where can you watch it right now?
Both seasons are on Netflix.
Oh, cool.
It's so dumb because I loved Scott and Bailey so much, which is a show by the same person. Like, I don't know why I haven't gotten around to it. I will take this nudge and make myself watch it. I'm certain.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say season one is as good as any prestige TV I've seen in years and years and years and years. And it's just up there. It's up there with Cracker and Prime Suspect as like great British cop TV making with like iconic performance right at its center. So yeah, Happy Valley. It's on Netflix. Check it out. All right. Well, Julia, Mom.
That is disturbing.
It's great to have you back. It's just, it's tough not having you be the, you know, angry mommy authority figure of your... Should I get a job at the LA Times just to keep the psychodrama alive?
I mean, we're hiring, man. Take a look. I'm happy to boss you around anytime, Steve, just recreationally, if that's what you prefer.
Okay, well, let me know if you need like a chiseled bodyguard. Dana, thank you. Always a pleasure.
Always.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. You can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/culturefest. We got a Twitter feed. It's @SlateCultFest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our production assistant is Alex Barish. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you soon.